Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of the group People for the American Way, who discusses the coming high-stakes Senate debate and vote on confirming a successor for retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Bill Fletcher Jr., a lifelong labor activist and author, who assesses the damage suffered by the U.S. labor movement resulting from last week's Supreme Court ruling in the Janus versus AFSCME case. And Jim Torn, founder of the group Footprints for Peace, who talks about a 1,400-mile bike ride he organized to bring attention to the case of indigenous political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who's been incarcerated for 43 years. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amid the Trump regime's brutal crackdown on migrants from Central America, detainees have been subjected to forced labor, a pernicious form of human trafficking. According to In These Times magazine, private prison corporations, who operate most of the nation's immigrant detention centers, are illegally forcing migrants to work for sub-minimum wages. Over the last year, lawsuits have been filed against CoreCivic, formerly the Correction Corporation of America, and GEO Group. The lawsuits claim prison company staff have threatened detainees with solitary confinement or the withholding of basic goods like food or toilet paper if they refuse to work 7 days a week. The lawsuits are all related to the voluntary work program run by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, that offers work to detainees for $1 a day. A 2014 New York Times investigation identified 55 immigration detention centers running the volunteer work program, 34 of which were run by private corporations. There's reason to believe thousands of the roughly 35,000 people in immigrant detention are currently being coerced into labor. In some detention facilities, the labor program has provoked hunger strikes and protests. However, in previous lawsuits, U.S. courts have ruled detained immigrants are not employees and therefore are not protected by U.S. labor law. Okay. Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram, now an affiliate of the Islamic State, emerged as a murderous threat over the last decade in the Lake Chad Basin. Its name literally means Western education is forbidden. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, the Islamic movement has kidnapped over 1,000 children and killed over 2,300 teachers. The group gained international attention when it kidnapped 276 schoolgirls in Chibok in 2014. Despite a three-year offensive to wipe out Boko Haram, the insurgency still carries out regular attacks against schools and villages. In mid-June, a pair of suicide bombers killed 31 people in the city of Damboa during the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, demonstrating that the terrorist group still has the capacity to inflict mass casualties. It's estimated that 57% of schools in Borno State, in the heart of the insurgency, are closed, and over half of the state's schools have been destroyed. But in a sign of resilience, UNICEF and humanitarian agencies are offering free open-air classes for primary school students. In Maiduguri, a bustling city of 1 million, secondary schools have reopened, and many are now absorbing thousands of students and teachers from other parts of the state. Minutes after the tragic crash of a Cuban airliner as it took off from Havana's Jose Marti International Airport, state-run media was filled with breaking news updates and cell phone videos reporting on the crash that killed 112 people, the worst airline crash in Cuba in decades. This openness in the Cuban state media is a new development under newly named President Miguel Díaz-Canel, even as independent print and broadcast media remains banned. According to the Associated Press, the Political Bureau of the Cuban Communist Party has approved a new communications policy to give state media more flexibility in reporting breaking news. Media outlets are also now allowed to sell advertising to Cuba's small but emerging private sector. Cuba still has one of the lowest internet use rates in the world, but access is now expanding rapidly. Cubans with online access can find a nearly unlimited range of media outlets, from independent Cuban online magazines to anti-Castro outlets funded by the U.S. government. Many of those sites are blocked, but their content can be accessed through Facebook and other social media. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump welcomed the news that Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy would be retiring before the critical midterm election this November. Trump is now moving quickly to nominate a successor to replace Kennedy, which creates an opportunity to cement in place a conservative majority on the high court for a generation to come. Nominees he'll be considering come from a list compiled by the right-wing Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. Although he was appointed by a Republican president, Kennedy had a reputation of being a moderate voice on the court due to his alliance with liberal justices on key cases involving gay rights, abortion, and affirmative action. However, Kennedy, more often than not, sided with conservatives, most notably writing the controversial 2010 Citizens United ruling that struck down limits on corporations' campaign spending, and in the 2013 Shelby County v. Holder case that gutted the Voting Rights Act. With Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell pledging to vote on a Trump nominee this fall, Democrats are crying foul, pointing out that after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, McConnell took the unprecedented step of blocking a vote on President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland until after the 2016 election, when Trump's nominee Neil Gorsuch was confirmed. Your reporter spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who discusses what's at stake in the coming Senate debate and vote on confirming a successor for Justice Kennedy.
There's no question that the addition not only of Alito, but most recently of Gorsuch to the court, has given new energy to those on the far right, and they were able to succeed in getting Justice Kennedy, who is himself pretty conservative, to go along with them in all of those very troubling cases. No question that we need to win more presidential elections and get people appointed to the Supreme Court a lot more like Sotomayor and Kagan and Ginsburg, who've done an heroic job in dissenting from those decisions. But as bad as those decisions are, it could be even worse if Trump can put another Gorsuch or somebody else from his list on the Supreme Court to replace Kennedy.
What's at stake, in your view, in terms of Supreme Court rulings in the future that could affect generations to come? What are some of the high-stakes issues that the justices will likely be deciding in the years ahead?
Well, we're really talking all the marbles. I mean, there are cases already on the court's docket that relate to abortion, to lots of other issues. But Kennedy has been the thin dividing line that's made the difference between, for example, overturning Roe versus Wade, which the right really wants to do, and preserving some reproductive rights for women. That one is high on the chopping block if they're able to get someone like a Gorsuch in to replace Kennedy. Challenges to the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Trump has a lawsuit going now with Mr. Sessions that tries to argue that it's unconstitutional for Congress to require insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions. Add a justice like Gorsuch to the court, and there's serious concern about what happens in a case like that. LGBTQ rights, equal marriage rights, others. Kennedy was the author of many of those crucial decisions, and there have been clear indications from the conservatives on the court that they'd like to get rid of that awful decision, according to them. Stopping executive abuse. He was the deciding vote in the author opinion that said that President Bush couldn't lock people up at Guantanamo without at least a writ of habeas corpus. That one could be gone, too. All these and more are seriously threatened if you have another Gorsuch or someone potentially even worse replacing Kennedy on the Supreme Court.
Certainly, one of the options that Democrats have is to convince one of a handful of Republicans who are on the record opposed to the overturning of Roe versus Wade to oppose a nominee that would likely do that. And that includes Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. But then there's the problem of red state Democrats who are in tough election years. Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Claire McCaskill in Missouri are four that I've heard may be convinced to support a Trump nominee. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in play here and what you're leaning towards as a wise and effective option?
Well, you are absolutely right. There is a narrow path to victory here for progressives, and the path goes through those six states. Right now, the Senate is only 50-49 because Senator McCain is unlikely to return from Arizona. So that means we need to hold the Democrats, or almost all of them, and get a net of one Republican vote. And that's not easy, but it's definitely doable. We have already begun efforts to reach out to people in those states and try to get them to contact their senators. We're looking very carefully at all the statements they've made. Senator Collins, for example, has talked about she doesn't want to see a judicial activist. The primary contenders for the Supreme Court seat are exactly that, and that needs to be explained very carefully. But whether the method used is to actually vote a nominee down or potentially to vote in the Senate to delay considering a nominee, which a majority of the Senate will do, we need that. We need a majority of the Senate. And we've already begun efforts, and it's critical to have people like your listeners involved with that to convince those six senators and others, although most other Democratic senators, I think, are pretty clearly on the right path already from the statements they've made. But to convince, I would say, five out of six of those senators to do the right thing, whether it's on a procedural vote or on a vote on the merits on the nominee.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way. Find more commentary on the political fight over filling Justice Kennedy's Supreme Court seat by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Following a pattern of decisions hostile to the U.S. labor movement, the Supreme Court ruled on June 27th that public sector unions could no longer charge agency or fair share fees to employees who declined to join the union, but who continue to benefit from the contracts unions must negotiate with management on their behalf. The case, Janus versus Ask Me, decided by a 5-4 vote, overturned a 40-year-old precedent set by the High Court in the 1977 Abood versus Detroit Board of Education case. The conservative court majority justified their ruling, which dramatically undermines unions representing police, firefighters, teachers, and other government workers across the U.S., by claiming that requiring public employees to pay agency fees is a violation of their First Amendment right to free speech, even though agency fees cannot be used to pay for union lobbying or political activity. As a result of this ruling, it's predicted that hundreds of thousands of workers will likely opt out of paying agency fees, thereby reducing public sector union revenue and their political influence. This is exactly the goal long sought by the conservative anti-union groups who bankrolled the Janus case. Your reporter spoke with Bill Fletcher Jr., a former senior staff person with the AFL-CIO, past president of Trans-Africa Forum, and a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. Here, Fletcher assesses the damage the ruling in the Janus case may cause the U.S. labor movement and how unions could respond.
In a Supreme Court decision called Steel versus Louisville Railroad, 1944, set the precedent for all future duty of fair representation cases, the court was very clear that a union, because it has exclusive representation rights, was obligated to represent fairly and equitably all workers in the bargaining unit, irrespective of union membership, meaning that the union had to represent people who were non-union. In the public sector, what happened over the years was that workers, when employed, would not have to join the union. However, they would pay a fee, which is the agency fee or fair share fee, that would cover the cost of representation. Whether the worker is in the union or not, the union has to represent them on any credible grievance. That means that they have to take it to arbitration if necessary, which can be very expensive. The union might have to litigate a matter in court. It may be something that has to be taken before a state legislature or a city council. All of this costs money. What the Supreme Court was saying was that, yes, we hear that, but it's going to be up to the union. The union will have to use its own resources to pay for this, because to ask a worker to pay their fair share is somehow an infringement on their freedom of speech. Now, the other part of this that is critical to emphasize is that being in a union does not in any way stop your freedom of speech. You can be a union member and not agree with unions. You can be a union member and oppose the leadership of the union. You can be in a union and oppose the stand, the political stand that the union takes. None of that is prohibited by being a union member. So the whole notion that this was about free speech is nothing more than sophistry. It really was about crushing the power of organized workers. That's what the decision was about.
What's the likely fallout from this Supreme Court decision? We've heard predictions of the loss of hundreds of thousands of dues-paying workers, non-union members who could decide to opt out of paying their fair share fees. How much could this weaken the labor movement in the United States?
Well, there's no question but that it could possibly weaken the unions, because what you have to understand is open shop is what it's called when workers don't have to join the union or pay a fee, called right to work in some states. What open shop does is that it appeals to greed. And it's really interesting because there's no other institution in the United States that is obligated by law and with no governmental subsidy is obligated to represent people who are not making a contribution. It would be as if the people of a city or town were given the option of paying taxes, but they would be guaranteed fire, police, sewer, water, and education. That's the equivalent. So that's why it's so completely ridiculous. So this will drain resources of unions. There's no question about it.
With record inequality that we see in the United States, some of the worst rates of inequality anywhere in the world in the industrialized nations, and now with a burgeoning militant teachers union movement in a lot of unexpected places, including Oklahoma, we have maybe an opportunity now during this Trump administration where they've gone full tilt in favor of corporations and against workers and in decisions they make day after day. Is there a potential here in the wake of this Supreme Court ruling that you'll see a lot of new energy and militancy among the labor movement?
There's tremendous potential, but there's been potential for a while. And so, for example, you think about in 2011 with the Occupy movement, you think about the Madison uprising in Wisconsin. Workers have demonstrated time and again a willingness to resist. The challenge, however, is that if you don't have good organization and good leadership, what this becomes is a phenomena of periodic eruptions, but not a major insurrection. One of the things that I've been feeling for a while is that we need to challenge the corporate right exactly where they least expect us to, which is insisting upon rights at work, not right to work, but rights at work. So one thing that I have been advocating for a while is the necessity for unions and other economic justice organizations to be pushing around the country fights to bring about a democratization of the workplace, rights at work, beginning with basic protection against unfair terminations. So there's ways of turning this around, but we need the union movement to step up to the plate and act as a real fighting organization or set of organizations that's not just looking out after its own members.
That was Bill Fletcher Jr., a lifelong labor and racial justice activist and author of several books, including They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Find more analysis and commentary on the Janus ruling by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Leonard Peltier is probably the best-known indigenous person held behind bars in the U.S. In 1977, he was convicted of killing two FBI agents during a period of extreme violence on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota and sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. His trial was rife with improprieties, including perjury by key witnesses for the prosecution, the withholding of evidence in his favor, and more. He has consistently been turned down for parole, and President Barack Obama declined to grant Peltier clemency before leaving office. An international campaign to free Peltier has been ongoing for 40 years. As part of that campaign, a Cincinnati-based group called Footprints for Peace just completed a 1,400-mile bike ride from Cincinnati, Ohio, to the Pine Ridge Reservation. Since 2005, the group has sponsored long-distance runs, walks, and bike rides to promote causes such as nuclear nonproliferation and indigenous rights, and has specifically organized three bike rides on behalf of Leonard Peltier. Footprints for Peace founder Jim Torin, along with three others, rode together to the Pine Ridge Reservation, where the Peltier case began on June 26, 1975. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Torin, who talks about the bike ride and its goals.
This year, it just seemed right for us to ride to where it all started, which was the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. We started in Cincinnati on May 27th, and we rode approximately 1,400 miles every day, stopping at a new location. We had several Methodist churches that hosted us, usually provided us a meal and a meeting with the community. And we also had a little app called Warm Showers that is a collective of bicyclists that if you agree to let bicyclists come to your house and stay, in return, they'll let you stay at their house. That's where we stayed most of the time. And the idea behind it is just like the walks and the runs. When we stay with a community, we meet with that community and we talk about Leonard Peltier and give them information on what that case is about, and in turn they tell us what's going on in their community, and we just carry all that information with us. So a lot of people refer to it as like that pebble that gets thrown into the water. It might not seem that it means a lot right there, but it's as it spreads out, that information keeps going and going and going.
How did the people you spoke to respond?
Well, I mean, most of them responded the way most people respond, which is, I can't believe I've never heard of this. And then we showed the documentary several times, the incident at Oglala, the Leonard Peltier story. And hopefully after that, you know, because we also give out the information on what they can do to, you know, ask the president for clemency, which is to write the White House, call the White House hotline, and now tweet, because that seems to be to get anyone's attention nowadays, including the president's. So hopefully they felt passionate enough by the time we got done talking to everybody that they went out and did those things. Because that's the only way that we're ever going to seem free, is that if enough people will follow through.
If people haven't heard of Leonard Peltier's case, what do you tell them?
The thing with the Peltier case that is important to me is that Leonard did not get a fair trial. And all of that information is there through the Freedom of Information Act. And I believe that if he would have received a fair trial, then he would have been free. He wouldn't be sitting in a prison right now. And that's the thing that I try to stress with people. If you've seen the documentaries and you've read the books, if you have a conscience of any kind, you cannot say that he received a fair trial. He deserves one, and he should receive one. And then when he does receive that, he'll be free.
So, Jim Torin, what happened when you got to Pine Ridge?
Every year they have what they call the Oglala Commemoration. Commemoration is on the day of the actual shootout, which is June 26th. The first night we rode our bikes in, and we had a nice little grill out with the community. They showed us around the property. They've got some nice memorial plaques out there now for Joe Stuntz, who was killed during the shootout, and for Leonard, of course. And then the next morning, there was a youth run from Camp Freedom to the little cemetery, and then a big group of people walked with an honor drum in front. They were singing songs in front, and then we walked behind the truck for approximately 2 miles. And then they had speakers that came, people that were actually there, and then afterwards they fed the community. People haven't forgot. We just need more of them.
I have an Indigenous friend who posted to Facebook that if Trump hates the FBI so much, then he should grant clemency to Leonard, since it's the FBI that has always adamantly opposed his release. So what can people do to support him?
If you want current information on what to do for Leonard, then you should go to whoisleonardpeltier.info, and that's his website for the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, and you'll find all the information on how to donate, which is very important because lawyers aren't cheap. You'll be able to find out where all the information on what you can do on letter writing campaigns, and those are upcoming, directed directly at the president. Most importantly, send Leonard a letter because he appreciates them. It lets him know that people are still supporting him.
That was Jim Torin, founder of the group Footprints for Peace. Learn more about the campaign to free Leonard Peltier and Indigenous activist groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.